Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is Nicole Sullivan. Nicole is a front-end performance consultant, a CSS aficionado, and an author. She is behind Type-O-Matic, an open-source project, which we will probably get into today. She's written a style guide for CSS. She's been mastering Ruby of late. She is a co-founder of the CSS conference called CSS Conf. She's the co-creator of Smush.it, an image optimization service in the cloud, and CSS Lint, a tool that helps correct common CSS errors before they are pushed to promotion. She's consulted with companies like Facebook, Salesforce, W3C, Adobe, PayPal, and Box. And she blogs at stubbornella.org. And she's the author or co-author of the Web Performance Daybook Volume 2 and Even Faster Websites. And that's just off the top of my head. So where do you find time? Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the show.
When you say it like that, it makes me sound like a crazy person doing so many different things.
Do you ever just like watch TV or walk on the beach or anything like that, or not very much?
Yeah, I do. I go to the beach pretty often with my dog. She loves running around and chasing the ball and stuff like that.
Okay.
But thanks for having
me. Well, thanks for coming. While I'm thanking people, and then we'll get into it, I want to thank our sponsor, Typekit. We've all heard of Typekit, and Type-O-Matic fans will certainly be interested in Typekit. Typekit changes the way you design websites by making it easy to use stunning real fonts instead of browser defaults. Add a line of code to your pages, it's a line of JavaScript actually, and choose from hundreds of quality typefaces. It's simple, reliable, and makes for a more beautiful web. Try it out for free at Typekit.com. That's Typekit.com, bringing beautiful type to the web since 2009. And remember before Typekit? Nicole, you remember because you've been doing this a while. Before Typekit.
Remember? Before Typekit, we had to keep making fonts smaller and smaller because the bigger they got, the crappier they looked.
It was just Georgia and Vertana. Yeah, Vertana looked really great small, especially in the pixelated days. It was a great font. Georgia and Verdana were designed to look amazing with no anti-aliasing. That's really where they looked best. Small at specific pixel sizes. I know you're a big fan of pixel sizing. I'm kidding.
You are also the
founder of the open source project Object Oriented CSS, which is about scaling CSS for millions of visitors and thousands of pages. And I think we've talked about this before, but get a little background on that, if you please.
Sure. Object-oriented CSS is basically the idea that that CSS can make sense, that it doesn't have to turn into a tangle when you've had a project running for 6 months or 2 years. And so it's about figuring out what the best practices are that create CSS that allows you not only to build what you're building today, but to be able to basically construct the little Lego that you're going to need in order to build something in the future that you haven't even necessarily imagined yet.
And it's not just for big, I mean, originally, when I heard about object-oriented CSS, I was like, well, yeah, that's great for, you know, sites like Facebook that have like 30 front-end developers at any given time working on just one section. But I've actually, in recent days, I'm starting to think that some kind of methodology like this is good for every site. I'm working on a site now. It's very small, just two people working on it, a developer and a designer who's also a developer. And as soon as the designer, who's also a developer, goes in to update something, he's like, I wonder why so-and-so did it this way. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense. I'm changing this rule, but nothing's happening. Mm-hmm. And then they either get into the trap of writing more and more and more specific rules. I think that's one thing you're trying to avoid, right? Like where you have like 1,000 pound signs in front of a rule to
really, really, really unique identifier is what
right.
that means.
Right.
The benefit is more for bigger teams and bigger companies because it allows better collaboration. But I can't tell you how frequently I regret that my own blog is not coded with OOCSS when I'm trying to change something and it won't go and it doesn't work. I mean, I think with any small project like a blog, it's honestly okay to do it however, because if you could recode the whole thing in a weekend, then it just doesn't matter that much how it's coded. But Yeah, I think when you think about maintaining something over the course of years, I mean, now, gosh, my blog has been up for, I can't even tell how long, probably a decade-ish. And, you know, all that time, all the wasted time maintaining things because I didn't build them the right way first. So, yeah.
I can relate to that. I have so many weird, embarrassing, my CSS is embarrassing. And I think I have,
too.
Until recently, I even had some old rules that had to do with a JavaScript-based style switcher that I had in there in like 1999 or something. That, you know what I mean? It's just like
there was
still something there, and there were
The shoemaker's children never wear shoes or something like
that. I would get embarrassed when people who read my stuff and think that, you know, and agree with my principles would criticize someone's site that was much better coded than mine for not living up to the principles that I also wasn't living. Sad.
Mm-hmm.
But you,
I've gotten asked about my blog when I was talking to a potential new client, they're like, well, but you know, why haven't you coded your own site the way you're talking about? And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I really should have, but I haven't touched the CSS in years, and so it's easy to just kind of leave it. And I think this actually brings up a good point. A lot of people wonder how if they decide that, okay, OOCSS or SMAX or BEM, these sort of methodologies, they actually make sense and they want to go forward with one of them, they kind of wonder, how do I get from where I am now, the sort of chaos that I have, to one of these more structured methodologies? And
start over, right?
Well, it doesn't have to be. At least for big companies that I work with, I recommend looking at what are the most trafficked pages and what if you just converted those over, or what if you looked at just the pages that you're changing the most frequently. So probably adding blog posts if it's the blog, or, you know, it depends what kind of site it is. It might be the product page. It might be a search page if it's like I worked with Trulia, and they do real estate search. So their search results page and their product detail page are hugely important to them. So they can decide to change those two pages, and they don't have to change every single page on the entire site. They can, or every single view. They can go ahead and get a pretty big benefit out of just changing a few, depending on what strategy they want to employ for figuring out which few make the most sense to change.
So it sounds like your clients are developers themselves.
Yeah, often I work with people directly. So like when I worked with Trulia, it was really fun. They sent, I think, 3 or 4 developers and a designer and 2 designers to come and be a part of my team for a few weeks. And so we got to pair together. Every morning we'd have sort of brainstorming whiteboarding sessions where we'd figure out who was going to work on what, and sort of a general approach. You know, someone would say, okay, I'm going to build tabs. And we'd talk about different approaches to building tabs, like, you know, inline block versus float versus, you know, flexbox or whatever other ways of lining up tabs. And when we had sort of a general idea, okay, given the pros and cons, we're going to try this way first. They'd go off and they'd code for a bit and come back. And it was really collaborative and really fun.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was great.
So you do a lot of on-site consulting?
It depends. Every project's different. Some projects really require that. Other projects, if the team doesn't have enough resources to do the work that they're already trying to do, then I can take a chunk of work outside, get it done, and bring it back, which for some companies that's going to be just a better way of getting things done. But
if they don't understand what you did or why you did it, they'll mess it up within a week. So you still have to explain it to them, I imagine. Right?
Usually I do a workshop that sort of shows off how to use the components that have been built. So that's helpful. And it basically get everybody in a room and have them go through their first failures together so that we can catch it and say, okay, well, faced with this, what other solutions did other people come up with, and sort of teach them to start helping each other as well. Because I can't be always come to me. That wouldn't scale. So they need to, you know, start having experts in the room. Often a few people will have worked more closely with me, and then they become the helpers for the workshop, that kind of thing.
I forget this, but how did you, I mean, today you're a well-known, internationally well-known CSS consultant and code consultant, but at one time you were a kid, what was your educational background? Were you always playing with computers? Did you major in computer science, or what was what's the deal there?
My background is very long and very twisted.
Okay.
It's lots of different things. So I went to college and I just soaked up getting educated. I'd gone to a high school that wasn't very strong academically. And so getting to college, I just, every time the course catalog came out, I was excited and like picked out whatever I wanted to take. And at about 2 or 3 years in, my father was like, okay, you do realize you've gone to school to actually graduate at some point. So I added up all the courses I'd taken, physics and chemistry and speaking and some writing courses and math. And all. I just took whatever. And I figured out which degree I was mathematically closest to attaining. And it turned out it was an economics degree. So that's what I studied.
You understand that that's very unusual. A lot of people go to college and try to take film classes or learn as little as possible. But like a lot of people go to college so that they can drink beer and have sex and not have parents around.
Uh-huh. Well, there was a bit of that too.
Well, but it's almost like a, right. But there can't have been that much because you were doing a lot of work. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think that, having come from modest circumstances and having realized that education wasn't something, like a lot of people take it for granted, everybody gets to be educated, right? But I graduated 7th in my class in high school, and I had no idea, not even within 10 years, when the two world wars were. Like I couldn't have guessed, right?
This was in
and
a
so
fishing
and that
village?
Wasn't because I was dumb. It was a small island off the coast of Maine. Yeah. And so I think, having seen that education is something that I really wanted, you know, I was so excited to have school be hard and to have to work hard for it, I guess, because I had seen that I was missing all these pieces of information.
You didn't come to it from an indulged middle class background.
Not at all.
Right.
Yeah, not at all. So it was like, I just felt so lucky to even get that. I mean, and I was working 1, 2, 3 jobs to pay for school and things like that. So
yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to say I never skipped class. I always seem to sign up for math class at like 8 a.m. in the morning. And so I missed that, unfortunately, more often, now that CSS 3 is so geometric, I really wish I had gone to more of those math classes. But
yeah, but you wouldn't remember it anyway.
Honestly,
I mean, the great thing is that you're still in college in a way because you're a web developer.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, I saw a talk by Anna Tudor at CSS ConfEU. Oh, my goodness. She blew my mind. Like, she's making like rainbow geometric animated shapes that animate from different shapes to other shapes. And it was just so crazy cool, and that I even understood little parts of it made me incredibly happy.
When you see work like that, right, or like Leah Veru, one of your CSS Conf co-founders, will do these things where she makes like a unicorn shape out of. Aside from the fact
out of
that
CSS gradients or
right,
or,
right.
or border radius makes an animated little man.
Border radius makes a Charlie Chaplin figure that dances or something. It's like, so part of it's
I think she could.
Yeah. And part of it is just in awe that A, that a browser can render that, B, that a human being could figure out how to do it, C, that the spec supports that. But then you also, there's always, that's great, but in the real world, what I really need to do is just make buttons seem more responsive or give a nice treatment to photographs or make sure that everyone has a good reading experience regardless of what device they're using and how that device's manufacturer defines what a pixel is or whatever. So is there a disconnect between what CSS aficionados, you know, do for love and just for sport and what, or does that help you be better? I guess, does an experiment like that, or Eric Meyer used to do these crazy experiments too, where he made like honeycombs out of
I remember that one.
Okay.
The Spiral.
The Spiral, Complex Spirals, his production company is Complex Spiral Productions.
Mm-hmm.
How does it help you? Does that kind of sport make you better at solving the kind of, you know, belt and suspender problems that most clients have?
Yeah, I guess so. I've always been sort of deeply pragmatic about it. Like, what interests me in CSS the most is building scalable systems, like making it easy for people with various levels of understanding of CSS to be able to make front end without breaking things, and how to have big companies be able to do build what they need to build. So that's my kind of end of the interest spectrum, and how to make it fast as well. But when people do these experiments where they really push the boundaries of what's even possible, I often find there are little takeaways in it, little things that can be used for something practical. Or I think that's the wonderful thing about our community is that it's so diverse and has people interested in all different aspects and ends of what we do. And I like that because I'm not someone who and plays with gradients until I manage to make pointy arrows out of gradients. Right. But when somebody does that, then I can be like for example, I'm working on a project now with Pivotal Labs, working on they're building an open source tool called Cloud Foundry, which is all about being able to scale and deploy apps really easily to the cloud, and taking away some of that complexity. And we needed to have this little I don't know how to describe it. It's like an app indicator. So it lets you know the sort of the health of your app. And so it can say that your app is at 25% health or 50% health. It can say that it's running and everything's perfect. It can say that it's stopped. It has a bunch of different states. Well, so it's a combination of backend code, a little bit of JavaScript, and a bunch of CSS. But so it looks almost like a bullseye kind of a thing, with the colors of the bullseye changing depending on the health of the app. And so it was using something like 14 different images in order to do that, in order to create that look and feel with all the different colors for the different states. And looking at it, that made me kind of upset, because otherwise the app was almost entirely image-free. And so taking a peek at it, I realized that using Leah's CSS gradients, I could actually make the bullseye out of CSS gradients and make the different quarters different colors based on having multiple gradients. So that's a case where something that was sort of edgy actually got pulled back and made into something useful.
At your level of CSS, at your level of expertise, mm-hmm. How would you teach a beginner?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there are a whole bunch of ways. I always thought that the best way was to build up a good Lego system and have them use it for a while. And once they'd use it, they would have internalized a bit of why it matters to keep things separated into usable chunks, reusable chunks, rather. But lately I've been at Pivotal, actually we do 100% pairing. And so I'm pairing from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day, which means...
You mean working with another developer?
Yeah, two people in front of the computer working together, two keyboards, two monitors, but one computer. And we take turns. We talk about everything that we're doing. It's really interesting. And it's been kind of surprising and nice.
That's, you know, that's how art directors and copywriters used to work in advertising. It's still work in advertising.
Really?
Yeah, that was the big innovation in the 60s. It used to be that the client would tell the copywriter what they wanted. The copywriter would get drunk and make up a slogan. The copywriter would slip the slogan under the art director's door, and the art director would make it pretty. Kind of like bad website design. And then in the 60s, Bill Birnbach from Doyle Dane Birnbach figured out that if you put two creative people together,
they're actually more creative.
Yeah, and basically one sketch pad between them, and they can't leave the room until they have a great idea. But this sounds like the same thing. Two keyboards, two people with the same job, but one computer taking turns, educating each other.
So sometimes we cross pair as well. Sometimes we'll pair with the designer, and it's really helpful to me because I love implementing designs, but I don't necessarily design things myself. And so when I get to sit with Chetana, who's our designer, she explains the why in a way that has been really helpful for me. Like, I always cared a lot about making something match the mockups that I was given exactly, but she's helping me understand that the reason why the two typefaces are, you know, a certain distance and pixel, and why one is bold and not bold actually matters to how the user's going to interact with it. And that's been really cool to see. Like, it matters what the choices are.
Pairing seems like it would be great for design review too. It would actually work for a lot of things.
Yeah, it's hard though. Me being kind of on the introverted side of the scale, when I first started doing it, I slept so well. At lunches, I would go and like hide in a conference room or hide in a corner. And then in the evenings, I couldn't go out. And I basically have never slept better in my life. I was just exhausted at the end of every day. But I think it's sort of like a muscle, and I seem to have built up a little more strength, like going to the gym. And now I can pair, and I'm pretty comfortable with it. And it's, it is a lot of work. It's interesting.
You're not doing one line and then they do the next. Like you might make a whole rule, like for a particular alert class or something, and then they would make the next rule.
It's super fluid, and it depends. It depends on the person you're working with. Some people do it really like clear chunks, like one person codes in the morning and another in the afternoon. With most of the people I've been pairing with here, it's much more like once you've done it with them a few times, it's very like natural. Like they'll say, oh, wait, I have an idea about that, and they take the keyboard, and then you say, oh, but what if we refactor this so that we didn't have to have that selector twice, and you take the keyboard back, and it's not like a hard and fast rule. You do end up having to talk about it sometimes. Like, you know, occasionally someone keyboard hogs, or someone isn't, like, I've gotten feedback that I'm not taking the keyboard enough, and so I have to be like, okay, I'm going to try really hard to take the keyboard more. And it's a relationship, to be perfectly honest.
Right. But you're working with really talented people too. Like, you're really talented. They're really talented at, you know, maybe with complementary experiences. But
I've been learning Ruby from them.
You're learning, you know, talk about that a little bit. You've been writing some about your frustrations with Ruby too on your blog, right?
A little bit. Yeah. I'm so part of coming and working with Pivotal has been about, me upping my game and learning some backend languages and getting out of my comfort zone with CSS and doing something that I'm terrible at. And that's been incredibly fun and honestly inspiring to get back into being bad at things and to get to struggle and to go through that. And then they wanted to learn CSS and get better and level up in their CSS skills. And they're incredibly smart and motivated to figure out how to do this like other world, which they are, is maybe not their pure comfort zone. So it's been really cool.
What is your problem with Ruby?
I think my main problem with Ruby is that I don't know it yet, and I stumble and I sort of have to bang my head against the wall, and I seem to write one line of Ruby and then go to Stack Overflow, another line of Ruby, and then another Stack Overflow question, and it goes back and forth. So a big part of it is just me getting more familiar with it. I just have to learn it, right? Which I am doing. Like, I figured out how recursion works, and that was super exciting.
you were gonna do an infographic about that, weren't you?
Yeah, I think I will do. It's not done yet, but working on that.
Recursion is like inception.
Kind of interesting to me how someone who's more on the it's a little bit like that. David Hasselhoff wearing David Hasselhoff underpants helped me understand recursion a little bit.
That's brilliant.
Have you seen that?
I haven't, but that's brilliant.
Okay. It's brilliant and terrible all rolled into one.
Well, when you have David Hasselhoff by nature, it's going to be brilliant and terrible. So you said a minute ago you were at Pivotal, and at Pivotal you've also created this style guide for CSS, which I guess isn't an open source thing. And it's for the community, or is it for specific?
The style guide's not open source.
It's open to the other people to use.
To check out and see. Yeah. So. I think it's important for companies to be sharing their style guides so that we can all get better at this. I think it's something where we're kind of not quite, we haven't quite figured out how style guides are supposed to work yet. And so, this is open on the web, but not an open source project. The scaling and the cloud stuff is open source. The style guide is part of a very specific styles to this project. So,
is Typomatic open source?
Yeah. Typomatic is open source.
Talk to me about Typomatic. It's a Firefox extension that you made, and it's open source, contributed on GitHub. What is it, though?
So, Typomatic is a tool for going through your styles and figuring out what kinds of typography you're using. Most sites, after they've been through a few design iterations, end up with a lot of sort of loose ends typographically. 200 or 300 different styles is not uncommon. So basically, Typomatic goes through the pages of your site one by one and collects all the different type that's used on those pages. And so it keeps a count of which ones are used most frequently. So I found that often in my work, I was needing to get a group of designers together and to get them to decide what their styles really were. Because a website over time gets a lot of different iterations. Some of the styles are desirable. Some of them you're like, ooh, that doesn't quite fit with the others.
Or someone was guessing and they accidentally broke the, they changed the line height by a pixel.
They color picked and they got the wrong pixel. That happens. You get just slightly the wrong blue or whatever. So what we did was we built a tool that would go through and find all the typography that had been used on the site, get those counts, and that way when I was talking, because I found I was having to ask designers, which blue is the right blue? Is it this one or is it that one? And they were really struggling to answer those questions, and the conversations were taking a long time. They were starting to be about which is the right blue rather than which is our blue. And so getting some data, a count about how many times each of those blues was used, if one's used 1,400 times and the other's used 23, then it's really easy to see which is your blue. And so first you can consolidate on something consistent, and then if you want to have a discussion about whether that blue should be moved to be another blue, absolutely have that discussion. But until you have just the one blue, you can end up in sort of discussions that just don't lead anywhere.
Okay, so this is interesting to me. So Typomatic, and it's at type-o-matic.net. Typomatic, if you don't have a style guide, this is the one way to sort of work your way back toward it. Figure out what styles you've kind of evolved that, have kind of grown up by themselves, grown up like Flopsy, grown up by accident. Find out what styles you've kind of evolved later on, and it also helps you optimize, obviously. If you find that you're being redundant, you can, save the user's bandwidth by writing, less code and creating less redundant rules. Then you can have a style guide. And then on the other side of that was the tool of yours that we were talking about earlier, which is OCSS, right? It's like, here's...
OOCSS.
Sorry. OOCSS. That's all right. Here are guidelines to avoid needing Typomatic, but
I kind of think everybody's going to end up needing it.
Even with OOCSS.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's important for design to be able to iterate and to be able to try things and to not always have to have the end perfect answer all the time. And sometimes because we're busy, we don't manage to then consolidate all those things and make them make sense afterwards.
Sure, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I think it's okay to not be sure your answer is right, but to try it and then see what happens. And sometimes that leads to cruft.
And this, even if you're using a third-party font service, that won't matter because it's just looking at the CSS rules.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And so it's actually interestingly not looking at your CSS rules. It's looking at your DOM. So this was something...
Wow.
At first, we had it look at CSS rules, and then we realized that the CSS was even more full of crufty things not actually used on the site than the site was. And so it made sense to go DOM node by DOM node and figure out which were the typographical styles applied to that node, and then build our list out of that. That way, our counts are really how frequently are you using this style, not how many times was it declared in the CSS.
Some women in our industry have found that there's a lot of pushback, or there's a lot of sort of diminishment of their skills. There's sort of a questioning of, especially the developers, like, well, you know, you're a girl, so you can't really be that good at this stuff. Have you encountered that? And if so, what have you done to fight past that?
Oh, the tough question. Yeah, of course I've encountered that. You know, I think that sometimes it's unclear whether it's diminishment because I'm a woman, or whether it's diminishment because sometimes front end doesn't get the sort of acknowledgement for being as important as it is.
Right.
So true too. You know, it can be really hard to tell. You know, it's been very rare, not never, but very rare to have out and out misogynist behavior. I've had maybe a couple of different times in my career when people were, you know, I later found out they actually got investigated for how they behaved with women. But for the most part, people have been lovely. So, yeah, it's funny. I feel like there are a few stinkers sort of spoiling our soup, basically, that like we've got a whole bunch of really wonderful people, and then, you know, a few people who don't know how to behave properly. And I think it's important not to generalize and also, you know, honestly, to be okay with realizing that we're sexist. Like, I'm sexist, and a few years ago, I took a test at the Harvard Implicit Project, which can help you figure out your biases. Basically, it has you sort things into bins. So you'll sort women to the left and men to the right, and then you'll sort positive words to the left and negative words to the right, and then it inverts all those sortings for you. And has you keep sorting in different combinations of things. And it turns out if you have cognitive dissonance around a certain pair of sortings, like if you're racist, you're going to have trouble sorting positive words and black people, for example, into the same bucket. And it's super subtle. It's like a timing attack for your brain, because it's just going to cause like microsecond differences in how fast you're capable of sorting those two things into the same pile.
Project Implicit.
Yeah.
Can anyone register and take it?
Yeah. Yeah, anybody can. And they have all different tests, some for sexism, some for racism of various combinations and kinds. And when I took it, it said basically that I was sexist. And
wow.
Yeah. And that was honestly incredibly hard to take. I was like, no, I'm not. And then I started thinking about it and realizing that I was ever so subtly thinking when women were talking to me that it was maybe going to be less interesting, or I was maybe just giving the email like a little less of a glance than I would have if it had come from a guy. And I was like, oh my goodness, like that actually uncovered something real for me. And I tried not to judge myself, because it's, I, you know, obviously tempting, but to just be like, oh my God, I'm a jerk, or to shove it away and not think about it. But instead, I just tried to let myself notice when I was doing that, and believe that I don't want to be like that. And so if I just notice it, then it'll correct itself. And I'm not going to say it's completely corrected, but it is certainly far better than it had been before.
I think you're incredibly brave to say what you just said. So thank you for that. And I was watching I was trying to watch an old Mel Brooks movie the other day, and like the gay jokes, which were weird and not funny, but also like, did I ever think that was okay? Was that okay? Did everybody think that was, obviously not everybody, but did most people think that was okay? So I think, hopefully our attitudes were always like evolving and realizing how primitive we are in some ways, and hopefully getting a little bit less stupid about things.
It's hard because our brains are pattern matching machines, and once they've latched onto a pattern, they just don't want to let it go. This is part of why for CSS comps, our first round of judging of proposals, which actually, let me take this moment to say that we're taking a call for papers for CSS comp, and they're due on the 7th, so there's still time to get one in if you have a topic that would be interesting
7th?
To share. Yeah.
That's 3 days from when we're recording this, folks, so I'll get to that. Yeah, let's talk about this. It's 2014.cssconf.com. right?
Yes.
CSSConf.com, or just Google CSSConf.
Yep. And there's a link from there to submit a proposal. And we decided that what we wanted to do was judge the first round of proposals completely blind. So any identifying details, names, Twitter accounts, anything like that are stripped off. And the proposals are given a score just based on the topic. Nothing more. Yeah, kind of scary, right? Because, you know, you never know, like, will the person be a good speaker and things like that? And you get, you know, it's a complicated thing to do, to decide to do that. But we felt like it was more important to try to put aside our biases and not pick people just because we were familiar with them or because they'd spoken before, or even more so because, you know, they look like people we thought were smart or we thought were what
programmers. Everybody knows such and such, or because of their whatever, everyone knows so and so, so we should have them. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So this way we kind of eliminated that.
Have you learned anything yet, or it's still too early to say, like, wow, we learned that we didn't pick a single popular speaker. We only picked unknown people or unknown to us people or anything like that? Or
It turned out to be a good mix. It turns out that good speakers are also really good at writing good proposals. They've got experience, right? So that makes sense. So we're putting in place this year some links to help for beginning speakers, how to write a good proposal and what makes a good proposal.
That's a great thing to do.
Yeah. And then we got some people who'd never spoken anywhere before. Tim Hettler in particular was one of people's favorite speaker last year. And he did just a fantastic job, like completely knocked it out of the park, bringing in the practical and then pushing boundaries at the same time. And so, you know, he hadn't spoken anywhere before, but he turned out to be, you know, completely fantastic. So I think it ended up being a mix.
Is your logo made of CSS, by the way, the CSS Conf logo?
It's made of SVG.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Leah spent some time trying to make it in CSS, and then she was like, okay, this is silly. I should just make this in SVG.
Thank you. Okay, good. Yeah. So you did this with Leah Varu and Chris and Laura Williams. How long have you been doing this now? A couple of years? And you did it in Europe too? What's the story?
Last year was the first year. And it's paired with JSConf, which is nice because sometimes it seems like the CSS and JS communities just don't meet and hang out enough.
Right.
So we want to make that happen. So it was in Amelia Island, Florida last year, and then got brought to Berlin last year, and this year is going to Australia as well. So, and then back to Florida. So,
who are you working with in Australia?
It's a whole group of five different people. You can check it out at csconf.com.au.
CSSConf.com.au.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it is. But did these happen simultaneously? Are you simulcasting stuff to each other? Do you attend the other shows? Are you going to go to Australia to see it?
Yeah.
Yes, you're going to Australia.
Yeah, went to Europe, went to Australia. It's sort of a thing where it grows naturally. If someone wants to make a CSS conf, they can. But they have to attend one first so that they get the idea of the energy that we're trying for and the, you know, the way that it should feel. So
is it self-sustaining? Are you making enough money to cover your costs?
Yeah, but the idea is for it to be just self-sustaining and not, you know, not really any more than that. So that's, mostly.
How did you pick the location?
JSConf was already going to be at Amelia Island, and so we really wanted the two conferences to share a location so that those two communities could meet. Because, you know, the funny thing is I'll stand on on the Event Apart stage and ask someone if they've heard of Douglas Crockford, and they never will have heard of him. And then if I talk to the JavaScript folks and I say Jeffrey Zeldman, they're like, who? And I'm like, wait a minute, you guys should actually meet and talk to each other because there's some, you know, some cross-pollination that would be really helpful. And it's amazing how, given that our languages are so closely tied, that the two communities are as separate as they are is kind of surprising.
Right, and there are almost no people, JavaScript people, reading a list apart, and therefore there are almost no people contributing JavaScript articles to a list apart, and therefore the thing, it just perpetuates.
It perpetuates itself, yeah.
So and that's a really great idea. How did you know who to reach out to make that happen? Did you just say, hey, is there more space available on Amelia Island? Can we do something there too?
Well, so I had been to a few JIS comps. I seem to be one of the people that bridges the two communities, though there are several people that do. I had spoken at JIS Conf and attended a couple of JIS comps, and I loved the community feeling of it. You know, people getting silly and, you know, staying up hacking and, you know, getting together. Often our industry can be a little solitary. You're sort of in your corner working on your thing, and I wanted CSS folks to have that too. And so I at some point said to Chris, who started JS Conf, hey, I think this should exist for CSS Conf too, for CSS folks as well. And he really encouraged me. I don't think I would have dared to do it if he hadn't encouraged me to try.
It's funny. I think 10 years ago, all of us would have just gone to South by Southwest.
Yeah, South by Southwest is a little too big for me. I found the last time I went, I couldn't. Yeah, I didn't manage to meet up with people that I knew. I'd try to meet someone, and then there'd be such crowds that I couldn't get in, or I could, you know, it just didn't feel. Yeah, you're right, and I love South by Southwest for how the wonderful people that I met there, Aaron Gustafson, and got to know Cindy Lee better there, and you know all different people. And,
you're gonna make me cry.
Yeah,
I feel sad,
right?
I feel very emotional about that. About just going there over the years, hanging out, meeting all these amazing people, and you know, and having. The parties were never really interesting to me at all. That was never what it was about to me. Yeah. To me, the party was like sitting down in the hallway and realizing that the person next to you was Ethan Marcotte or something. Right? Just like that. That was it. Uh-huh. And I met all these people that I'd known on the internet. I met.
Yeah, it turns out they're real.
But the biggest thrilling surprise was meeting all the people that you didn't. So like, I expected to meet like Derek Plazek and Heather Champ and Steve Champion. These were like my early internet friends, and meet them and have them be wonderful. And they totally were, right? But what was really surprising was to like go hang out with some like Austin bloggers or some Dallas bloggers who were like half my age, and I hadn't even read them yet, and find out they were like wonderful and creative people and. Mm-hmm. I make friends that, you know, for life. It's pretty cool. So, yeah, it seems totally natural from a business point of view that South by Southwest would have gotten so big that it can no longer offer that particular joy to the earlier participants. But I think what has happened is that it's presented an opportunity for you and your colleagues to create CSS Conf, and for Eric and me to do an event apart, and Christina Halverson to create a conference on content strategy. And it seems like there's just a plethora of...
And like Texas JavaScript. And
Yes, and all the small regional ones, which are... And I've spoken at some, and I know you do too, regional conferences like all over the place where... And they bring, you know, the same amazing speakers that used to come only to the big conferences are now trekking to smaller towns in, like, you know, a remote part of Canada or something to talk. I think it's wonderful. So
you went to Canada, didn't you, for Jerry's conference?
Jerry Cody's conference?
Yeah. Didn't you have a conference?
I've been... Twice to, well, I used to go to Canada all the time because I have had relatives up there in Montreal. But I used to go to, I'm totally embarrassed that I'm for blanking the name of the wonderful people.
Sorry, I put you on the spot.
Totally. I love this conference too. And it's in the place where the telegraph was invented. It's a place so far out in the Atlantic Ocean. It's Jerry Cody's hometown. That might be why.
Okay.
But it's not her conference. I'm going to. What would I do? So when your brain no longer functions, I'm going to Flickr. Then I'm going to my sets and I'm going to scroll down until I see a picture, which I go, yes, yes, that Mark, the developer of a framework. Anyway, it'll come back to me. But, you know, do you worry? I wanted to ask you this earlier. It was Go Beyond Pixels.
That's
awesome. But as I'm looking at it, I'm seeing a picture of Mark, who created, Mark Otto, who created the big framework, Twitter's framework.
Oh, Bootstrap.
Bootstrap. And I love that these things exist and allow people to quickly put interactive stuff together and not be like wireframing for months and not be tied to waterfall. All that stuff is great. And Mark, you know, deserves our thanks for that. But I worry that for every Nicole Sullivan who's pairing with some brilliant, equally brilliant CSS coder at, you know, at a really leading edge shop, there are people who don't really know how to do progressive enhancement, don't know CSS all that well, don't really understand why semantic markup matters, who are not who are yet using these freely available tools, that these tools in a way could be as destructive to the front end as say Dreamweaver in the early days of Dreamweaver was, or earlier like HomeSite. I guess not HomeSite, but you know what I mean? That tools that did the front end for you, that designers would latch onto and then never learn about the front end, and that might be why the JavaScript community or the Ruby community doesn't think that much of the HTML community, because they think that we're these hacks who use these tools. Does that make any sense?
I don't think that they feel that way. I think that if anything, what I've noticed is backend developers are a little uncomfortable because they're in a domain they don't know as well. I'm actually pretty impressed with Bootstrap 3, I must say. There are things that I want to contribute to it so that I can, there are a few bumps, obviously. Anything you're going to use isn't going to be completely right. But I actually chose to use Bootstrap 3 on a recent project rather than building our own custom framework, in part because I knew that this project hadn't figured out exactly what we were doing yet. You know, we were needing to iterate quickly. We needed to try stuff out. And
no question that Bootstrap and other tools like that are brilliant for iteration. I like the idea that at some point, someone who knows what they're doing is going to come in and write different code. That, like, now that we know what we want to build, almost like, okay, we filmed this using a home movie camera, but now that we know what story we want to tell, let's go back and really do the cinematography right and block the actor's movements and write the script down and do it right, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I'm still...
We talked about that when we were starting this project that I'm using Bootstrap 3 on, and I said to them that I thought we could probably get 2 years, a year and a half, 2 years out of Bootstrap 3 before we would need to, before the problems that it would create would be the biggest problems we'd be facing, and it would make sense to take it out and do something on our own. And that felt like a good trade-off. You know, I think the thing is, when you start using a framework, you've got to realize that, especially if it's because your startup can't really afford front-end talent yet, or you just don't have front-end developers available, that eventually you're going to be sort of painting yourself into a corner and you're going to need to fix it, but that's an okay choice to make for now, as long as you're aware that's where you're headed.
And by the way, I think you have to be something of a developer to use this stuff. It's not like I could give my dad the URL of getbootstrap.com and he would then make something.
Right? No, but a back-end engineer can. You know, they can definitely look at Bootstrap and understand how it's supposed to work. I think the trouble is that a lot of people put things together with Bootstrap and then they start writing their own CSS and they make it very, very view specific. So when this thing is inside of this thing and this is inside of that and that's inside of this, then make it look like this. And so very quickly they break the Lego bits that Bootstrap provides and tie them to each other. So they're going to make their button blue, but only when it happens to be in the sidebar of the product detail page, something like that. And that when you've done that, that means you can't use that blue button anywhere else, and nor can you use a normal button where that blue button is, because you've written rules that are too strong.
Which gets you back to OOCSS.
It does, and I think Bootstrap actually follows tons of principles of OOCSS. There are a few things I'd like it to be a little more granular, so that I could just pull down the piece of functionality that I want and not get the extra stuff unless I've said that I want that too. But overall, I think it's really good. I think often the trouble is that if you skip to it without learning good practices around modularity, then you're going to end up with basically two competing CSS worldviews in your code. But that's avoidable, I think.
Well, I could talk to you for hours, but we are out of time. I really want to thank you for all the time you've given us today. It's been fantastic, and you're very knowledgeable and interesting, and thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. And thank you to Typekit, bringing beautiful type to the web since 2009 at typekit.com. Not that I need to say that for any of our listeners, because I think they all know who typekit.com is and why Typekit is awesome. But if they haven't tried it out for free, then they really should. Thank you to Typekit. Nicole, thank you so much.